Good evening again, and welcome along to But I Know a Man Who Can, which is a whole week of events here at St. Helens in which we want to look at the basics of Christianity. In a moment, there's going to be two pieces of drama to watch, and then Hugh Palmer, who's on the staff at St. Helens, will be coming to speak. Coffee comes round to the tables after that. Please do feel free to stay round as long as you like after that. If after tonight you want to hear more, then ask the person who brought you about other events going on this week, and particularly about the two opportunities that there are on Sunday when you could come along. But for tonight, we want to take a look at one man whose life was changed by Jesus Christ. Thomas met Jesus face to face, lived alongside him for the best part of 3 years, and then was the one disciple not convinced when the others claimed that they'd seen Jesus alive again after his death. Thomas hadn't. Did it happen? Well, Doubting Thomas, as he became dubbed, claimed he just needed more evidence.
Ding! Next, please. Ah, yes, Mr. Thomas. Thomas D.
Doubting.
Well, why don't you come and lie down? Make yourself comfortable.
Oh, right you are, then.
Off you go.
Well, I don't know why I'm here, really.
Yes, that's a question we all ponder from time to time.
Oh, no, not that. You know, why I'm here. You know, here, lying on this couch, talking to you, a shrink. Must be mad.
Yes, thank you. I'll be the judge of that.
Oh, no, I'm sane, all right. I'm sane, oh, yes. Frankly, it's everyone else that's gone completely potty.
I see.
What?
Just I see.
Who? Where? Oh, was it here? Did he come here? Oh, no.
Do you find the fact that I said, I see, significant?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, that's the whole point. Everyone else sees him, but never me.
I see.
What did you see exactly?
Well, you tell me. What did you see?
Oh, nothing. I just came in here, lay on the couch, started telling you why I was here, and you said, I see.
Ah, I see.
Oh, there you go again. Oh, you're making me sound paranoid. Oh, that's not a diagnosis, by the way.
Yes, quite so. Quite so.
Look, it's like this. There was this bloke. No, there is this bloke. No, there was. Look, I like to think there was this bloke, but some people are telling me there was this bloke, and he still is. Do you understand my dilemma?
Yes, I see. Why don't you just come and lie down?
Look, I don't want to lie down, okay?
I see.
Where? Oh, no! No, you don't get me like that. Got the measure of you. Met your type before.
Ah.
Not in a professional context, you understand?
Quite so.
Look, I knew this bloke for 3 years, and then he died. Well, he was killed.
I'm sorry.
I said he was killed.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it wasn't your fault. No. It was those Romans and Pharisees.
No. You don't understand. I was empathising. It's a counselling technique I picked up.
Oh, very good, yeah. Yes, I like that one.
I'm very pleased with it myself. I'm sorry you were saying?
He was killed. I mean, I saw it myself, and so did thousands of other people. But it's in the past. Life must go on. Am I right?
Right. Wrong. Who knows?
But then, my friends said they'd seen him, walking through walls, laughing, breathing, talking, eating fish, that sort of thing. I haven't seen it myself, of course, and they call me a doubter. Doubting Thomas, that's me! So, Doc, what do you think?
Well, why don't you tell me what you think?
What do you mean, what do I think? Look, I know what I think, don't I? That's why I've come here, to see you, to tell me what you think. That's what I'm paying you for.
Yes, is this the 5 minutes?
5 minutes? 10 minutes? It hardly matters. Look, it's obvious. They had a psychotic delusion. It's wish fulfillment. A grief-induced hallucination.
They are off their trolley. They are out of their tree. They are one penny short of a pound. The lights are on, but nobody's at home. I'm the only sane, rational one left.
Yes, yes, of course you are. Why don't you just come and lie down?
What are you trying to insinuate? That I'm some kind of a nutter, incapable of sane, rational thought or argument? I must be mad to come here, listening to your snidey innuendos, giving me questions when I want answers, and expecting me to pay for the privilege? Well, you must think I'm bananas.
Yes, yes.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not. And to prove it, I'm off. Got a rather pressing appointment, actually.
Yes, quite so.
Yes, well, your time seems to be up, Mr. Thomas. Yeah. Well, next, please. Ding!
£5,000, Orville the Duck, is a big start, household name with a big S. Come in!
5K, Orville the Duck, all without
Jesus. Yes.
Blame you.
Great deal, just. Showbiz! Hello.
Thomas.
Who?
D. Thomas, D4.
Desperate.
No.
Duck.
No.
No, no, no. D for Doubting. Doubting Thomas. Yeah. All right.
Doubting Thomas, not any old Tom.
No.
Dick and Harry.
All right.
Well, when I come to see you,
Jack, just a minute, I'll get your file.
Yeah,
file. Thomas Hardy.
No. Nah.
Tom and Jerry.
Nah.
Tom Jones.
Nah.
Thomas the Tank Engine.
Thomas the Tank Engine. Now, he was in here last week.
We were letting off steam.
Yeah. You see, we lined up this whistle stop tour of major cities for him.
He came in here, blew his top. Says we weren't working hard enough for him.
Yeah, we said, slow down, mate. Fact is,
your track record's not too good, we
said. Yeah. Bit of a runaway train, you see. Doesn't know his station in life.
Don't get us wrong. He's a major crowd puller, all right.
But he's got a bit of a problem.
Drugs.
Coke.
He's hooked on it. Can't run without it. Tom Thumb. Now there's a big star.
Hey.
Dylan Thomas.
Nah.
Doubting Thomas.
Doubting Thomas. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Oh dear. Not worked for some time every time, eh?
No. Well, that's why I'm here, really.
Come to the right place, then, Tom. Have no doubts about that.
Classic.
Brilliant.
Now, listen, the last thing you did was that soap powder commercial, wasn't it, eh?
Oh, no.
Now, that was a classic.
That was one of the best, that was.
Making advertising theatre.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Hey,
do you want to be Tom?
No, you be Tom.
All right.
Yeah. I see you bought that new washing powder.
Yes, so what? It does the job.
Well, have you tried Squeaky?
Why should I?
Well, it washes whiter than white.
And pigs might fry.
And those stale smells which so often get left behind.
I'll believe that when I smell it.
And if you don't mind me saying so, you're a bit of a Doubting Thomas.
I am the original Doubting Thomas. I have no doubts about
classic,
brilliant. The officer rolled in after that.
But you refused them all, Tom. Why was that?
Well, you see, I'm not really happy with the image we've got here.
You've got the makings of a big star.
A major personality.
Oh, I doubt that.
There you go!
Someone like you, Tom.
Already a major character and a bestseller.
Yeah. Oh, look, I've only mentioned four times.
You're a household name.
You're on the lips of housewives the length and breadth of the country.
Doubting Thomas.
Well, there's an epithet I'm not too keen on, actually.
It's your hallmark, Tom, isn't it?
I can see it now.
In panto with Lenny Bennett.
He errs on the side of incredulity. He pokes the eye of gullibility.
Give us your catch.
Yeah, go on, give us your catch, mate. Give us your catch.
All right, all right. And pigs might fly.
Classic! Brilliant!
Look! Look, I've got a problem with this whole doubting thing. It's just not me. It's just not true to life.
It's larger than life, Tom. That's the old point, isn't it?
Everyone loves a cynic.
Look, I'm not a cynic. Look, I'm not naturally inclined to disbelief. I'm not an unreasonable man. Look, put yourself in my shoes. It was just a question of evidence.
What do you suggest we do about it,
I've
then,
got it,
Tom?
I've got it. Doubtful Thomas. He's got a modicum of inclination towards disbelief.
No. Reasonable, Thomas.
Yeah.
Is the man what is on the Clapham omnibus? He will weigh up the pros and the cons.
Yes.
Not exactly showbiz, is it, Tom?
Not exactly theatre.
I've become a stereotype.
Well, perhaps you prefer gullible, Thomas.
Yeah, now he'll believe a man can be nailed to a cross.
Witnessed by hundreds of people.
Declared dead by the authorities.
Stuck in a tomb for 3 days.
In hot weather.
And then, single-handedly, roll away a huge stone.
Walk through walls.
And eat fish.
Yes. Yes, I would, actually. Look, just give me the evidence.
So bees.
You hammer tuned yourself while I put this on. Well, Fred, I never made it to showbiz, but teaching's as far as I got. They've got stories all the time, teachers, haven't they? I picked up one the other week about a teacher who said her class one lesson just to draw pictures of the police. And they all drew away, the kids, and she went round halfway through and saw pictures of police cars and police dogs and police men and women, and all was sort of fine. And she came behind one kid and saw what they'd been drawing, and they got one of those sort of ugly, twisted, leering, malicious faces. You know, the kind of face that only kids can draw and Picasso and Paul Klee can get money for. And underneath it, the kid had written, "Police is pigs." Teacher reckoned she might have a problem on her hand, so she thought she ought to do something about it, and she rang up the local police station. And next week she organised an outing down to the local nick. Down they went, crocodile fashion, and they had a fabulous day with the local police. They were able to put handcuffs on each other and take a few of them off. They could lock most of the policemen in the cells, and that afternoon they were allowed to take it on a trip. Police launches down the Thames, you know, they put on the hats in the morning, they tried the walkie-talkies in the afternoon, they got given ice creams, a lot. Fabulous day out. Well, the third week, she set them exactly the same exercise as they'd had the first week, draw a picture to do with the police. And she went round, it was much the same sort of things, you know, police dogs, police men and women, police cars, a few ice creams on top of them. And then she came to this original kid who'd sparked it all off, and he'd drawn exactly the same ugly, leering, twisted, malicious face. And at the bottom this time he'd written, "Police is crafty pigs." Which all goes to show, probably not very much, other than that our preconceptions can often colour our view of the evidence. And that happens for adults as well as for kids. Happens in the Times. They admitted it the other week. They once had an obituaries editor called John Lawrence, and he wrote a premature obituary of the then Duke of Norfolk. But of course he was convinced that the Times could never be wrong, so when the next day the Duke of Norfolk, understandably exasperated, rang in to claim he was still alive, John Lawrence's reply was this. He said, "Before we proceed any further with this conversation, Your Grace, perhaps we could establish precisely where you're phoning from." Yeah, when it comes to whether someone is dead, or alive. And especially when it comes to whether someone is alive today when they were meant to be dead yesterday, we do need to check how we handle the evidence. Or if there's any evidence to handle at all. And when it comes to Christianity, which means when it comes to the person of Jesus of Nazareth, and when we come to that astonishing claim that with him there really was a day when you could have said yesterday he was dead and today he's alive, then we've reached the crunch. We've reached the central plank of the Christian faith. And that's why we've photocopied this incident. You'll find it on these yellow sheets in the middle of the tables. It's a fragment of the evidence for that claim. Because tonight we want to see how those early Christians, how the New Testament writers handled the issue. And I think you'll find it a big help if you've got it in front of you. I want to draw two or three lessons from it. Here's the first of them. That for them, seeing was believing. That's the thrust of this whole episode with Thomas. And a good thing it is, because that's the way we naturally think and speak, isn't it? I believe it when I see it, we say. Doubting or not, I'm grateful for Thomas. Someone had to ask the kind of questions he asked. I don't know about you, but I'm wary of gullible Christians. Now, they do exist, don't they? You know, the kind of people for whom believing seems to be on the agenda from breakfast onwards. And as long as basically it's going to land up something good about God, they'll buy it. They can be a real pain for the cause. Now, not that it's only Christians who are gullible. There are plenty of others who are gullible as well, aren't there? Apparently there are some in Gloucester. The Gloucester Citizen reported recently that council tenants who die without giving 1 month's notice will still be liable to pay 4 weeks' rent. And the City Housing Committee voted to maintain that rule. Well, most of us, especially if we're not in Gloucester, have other assumptions about our ability to predict our death or to pay checks once we are dead. Now, I'm glad Thomas was a skeptic. And that's what he clearly was. Look how this incident begins. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and place my finger in the mark of the nails, and place my hand in his side, I will not believe." Now think of the situation. All of those surrounding Jesus would have been shattered by his execution on the cross, completely disillusioned. When you put your trust in Jesus for all those months leading up to the cross, you with your fears and he so confident. And when it turns out that your fears turn out to be correct and his confidence was misplaced, wouldn't you be disillusioned? Talk about once bitten, twice shy. I wouldn't be jumping back on the same bandwagon again within 36 hours, would you? Now, all that talk about having seen Jesus must have seemed very cruel to Thomas. Yet within 8 days, he has all the evidence he asked for. Look how it goes on. 8 days later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. The doors were shut, but Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. And put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not be faithless, but believing." And you know, as we'll see, Thomas is an honest skeptic. He doesn't move the goalposts when his demands are met. He's willing to follow the evidence before his eyes, even when it leads him to the conclusion he closed his mind to. Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Oh, we've debased the meaning of words so much these days. I doubt we understand just what an unthinkable thing it was for a Jew to have allowed the words, "My God," to pass his lips with reference to another man. They were the most fiercely monotheistic nation of their day. The only thing that's more extraordinary is that those words should have been accepted by another Jew. Now look, this story is important because people have often claimed that the resurrection is such a tall story, and it does seem it, doesn't it? They've often claimed the resurrection is such a tall story that all it is the product of wishful thinking. The disciples were so wanting to believe, they were so emotionally worked up, that they hallucinated. They imagined they'd seen it. Or more technically, some people claim that the disciples had this faith about who Jesus was, and they expressed it in these stories. They wrote it up in tales which involved them talking about seeing Jesus. Now, I've been looking at the accounts again in the last few days. And one thing seems crystal clear, that if we're going to play the wishful thinking game, we have to allow that wishful thinking can be in the minds of the critics just as much as in the mind of the gospel writers. Because you see, you're going to have to rewrite all the details of the accounts if you want to claim that that's what they're saying is what happened. You have to rewrite the whole chapter that John wrote. I tell you, he begins with the women. They're his first witnesses, though actually they have no legal value in the society of their day as witnesses. There's nothing to be gained by including them in, but John does. They're the first ones to discover that the tomb is empty. So what do they do when they see the tomb's empty? Run back and say, "He's risen." No. Now when they find the tomb's empty, they go back and they don't say, "He's risen." They say, "We was robbed. Someone's taken the body and we don't know where they put it." Hardly wishful thinking. And we're not seriously going to accuse Thomas of wishful thinking, are we? And whether doubting is fair or not, he's not believing Thomas. He is sceptical. He is the, in spite of 10 friends going on telling me I still need convincing Thomas. I know for him, seeing was believing. And nothing short of it would do. Well, he said, "Fine, okay, I'll buy that. You give me that kind of evidence and I'll believe. Seeing's believing." And if you say that, of course, I'm forced to say, "Well, I could have done, but it's too late. I mean, Jesus is gone, isn't he? If you got there in time, I could have given you that evidence. You could have seen him. You could have put your finger in the nail mark. You could have put your hand in the side, but it's too late. Or you're too young, whichever way you want to have it. We're the best part of 2,000 years too young." I'm not being cynical. Jesus recognized it. Look what he says to Thomas in verse 29. He said to him, "Thomas, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who've not seen and yet believe." He's saying to Thomas, "Thomas, you're standing right at the dividing point between one age and another, between a time when people would believe because they've seen me. And almost everyone else from you onwards, Thomas, is going to have to believe without having seen me. Yet they'll be just as privileged, just as blessed." And you say, "Well, I don't mind whether they're just as privileged or not. What you're saying is all I'm left to do, if I want to believe, is to leap in the dark." No, I'm not. If the first lesson from this incident is that seeing was believing for them, the second lesson is this: believing is not a step in the dark for us. Look, belief is not what you do when you've got no evidence. That's not belief, that's gullibility. The believing that's being talked about here, if you want to do that kind of believing, you won't be short on evidence. You're looking at one bit of it. I may not have seen, but Thomas had. I can believe because of someone else's testimony, can't I? I do it every day. so do you. We do it over thousands of things. I've never seen an atom in my life, but I believe they exist for years. I don't know whether you read in the newspapers, but a couple of Russian cosmonauts came back down to Earth on Monday. They'd been up in that Soviet space station Mir since September. You stop and think what kind of world they came back to. An incredible one for them. The Berlin Wall is now a quarry for souvenir hunters. Erich Honecker, the East German dictator, is on trial for treason. The Ceausescus have been shot. The seemingly impregnable Czech government has been displaced by a recently imprisoned dissident. And the area they landed was part of a strife-torn, wanting to secede bit of the Soviet Union. Ah, if they're going to believe all of that, they'll have to do it because of someone else's testimony, won't they? They weren't even on the planet when those things happened. Ah, they might just conclude it was all one giant conspiracy theory. There is still a Flat Earth Society. I met a student the other day who was trying to get a speaker from them. Now, what I'm saying is, if there are good grounds for it, we believe things because of someone else's testimony. And when it comes to this belief, yeah, seeing was believing. It did start that way. That's why John is writing. He wants to get the evidence out. He wants others who can't see to know there are good reasons for believing. See, if you want an event to be an event of history, it's going to happen at a particular time and in a particular place. And if you weren't there then, you'll have to believe some other way than seeing. So he explains exactly why he's written his book. That's what this last paragraph is all about. It's the obvious place for him to do it. Just been told a lot of people are going to have to believe without seeing. And so he says at the end here, look at this last paragraph. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. I noticed that. You may believe that Jesus is the Christ. That is what we're talking about, by the way. Believing that Jesus is the Christ. Please, some people have got this ethereal notion of belief or faith as if it's something floating around and we've somehow or other got to grab hold of it. And they wish we could all have a slice of it. People speak as if Christians are the only ones that believe and no one else believes. We all believe. Occasionally people come and say to me something like this. They say, I wish I had your faith. And I want to say to them, you have. You just put it in a different place. And John says, I'm writing this book so that you can put your faith in this place. That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. You see, he knew what was going on already as he was writing. And most probably he was writing closer to the ministry of Jesus than we are to the Second World War. Already, as John was writing, it was too late for his readers to see and believe. It's no easier for them than it is for us. But he says, there's plenty of evidence if you want to believe Jesus is the Christ. There's plenty of evidence for us if we're only willing to do our homework. And if that's what you're willing to do, we've got a couple of things that might help you. I've got a number of copies of a modern edition of John's Gospel, complete with pretty pictures, which are neither here nor there. And if you're willing to read through it, grab one on the way out. There's plenty of reasons here for believing that Jesus is the Christ. Please, don't write off the Gospels and say they don't count as evidence. Of course they're evidence. Jesus was an historical figure. To anyone who's done a scrap of research, that seems to me indisputable. And these are accounts of that historical figure. It's no good saying because they've come to one conclusion, it doesn't count as evidence. Now, actually, there's plenty of grounds for thinking that although they've come to their conclusions, they've not twisted the evidence as they do so. Or if you want evidence about this particular sign, well, we've got here another little booklet called The Evidence of the Resurrection, the last great sign that John records. And it's written by, I guess, the most eminent living lawyer, who was a professor at London University. I'm sure there's plenty of evidence. If you'd like to go about it another way, then in the middle of the tables there are some yellow cards we'll look at later on, which talk about various little discovery groups you can join in. There's plenty of evidence if, like Thomas, you're willing to stay around where you're most likely to find it. The point I'm trying to make is this. The difficulty people have in believing that Jesus is the Christ is not that to do that is to leap in the dark. Leaping in the dark is a dangerous thing to do, isn't it? It's a stupid thing to do. You break your leg that way. The difficulty we'll have in believing that Jesus is the Christ isn't that to do it is to leap in the dark. It's actually that it's stepping into the light. It's stepping into the light because that's the way the evidence points. Folks so often picture becoming a Christian as if we're left standing on a precipice and I'm just meant to leap out and hope that somehow or other there's something to land on. But if there's any precipice there, how do they think we ever got to that stage? Only because the evidence step by step by step by step led us here. And to turn around and say it's all rubbish and walk off again is to fly right in the face of all the evidence. There's a leap in the dark. Now, but the hard thing about this step into the light isn't just that it's stepping where the evidence goes, but as I step out into this light, I have to expose myself to the light. I have to live with someone other than me as my Lord and my God. And that is not just comfortable. None of us like losing control. Ted got a first in classics at Oxford, so I'll leave you to judge whether he was educated. But he came on down and he'd done bar finals and he was teaching law students when he joined one of these Discovering Christianity groups. First night in, he came in really aggressively with all his hostile questions. That's fair enough. It's the place for asking hostile questions. If you've got nice ones you want to ask nicely, that's allowed too. But if you want to ask them aggressively, that's the ground rules. That's fine. And he piled in with all his questions. A few weeks later, as he was talking, he said, yeah, well, he said, this is what's impressed me so far, that the Christian faith is a historical one. It's examinable. It's what makes it different from all the other beliefs and religions I've looked at. Oh, about a year ago, he was at a meeting a little bit like this. And his friend turned to him and said, well, what do you make of it all? And he said, yeah, he said, I'm convinced. I know what the person's saying is true, what they're saying about Jesus as the Lord and the God. I'm convinced. What are you going to do about it then, said his friend. And Ted said, oh, nothing. I don't feel good about it. I'm swinging in saying, well, no, there's no way I can go Christian because my head isn't convinced. Now his head's convinced and he's still not going Christian. Or take a medic who joined a similar kind of group. And first night in, very honestly, he said, listen, here's my position. I want to believe. I've got a lot of Christian friends. I can see what Jesus means to them and has done for them. He said, I want to believe, but I just can't find any good grounds for doing so. About 4 or 5 weeks later, he was explaining his position as it then was, and it was strangely different. He said, yeah, he said, I found the grounds for doing so. Now I'm happy about the evidence. I'm satisfied by it. But funnily enough, I don't want to believe now. He'd begun to understand something of what would be involved in calling Jesus my Lord and my God. Now, in the end, he had the, I don't know, courage, honesty, integrity, call it what you will, to follow the evidence in a way Ted hasn't yet. What I'm saying is we're not such moral heroes as we often like to think we are. For all his skepticism, you see, there's an integrity about Thomas. Seeing was believing for him. But when he saw, he stepped into the light and he said, "My Lord and my God." First point, seeing was believing for them. Second point, believing is not a leap in the dark for us. Here's the last thing that this incident is meant to tell us. This believing that Jesus is the Christ, is a life or death issue. Look at that last paragraph again, will you? Actually, especially that last verse. John says, "These things are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing, you may have life in his name." It's implicit in this verse, and it's explicit elsewhere, that not only do you have life wrapped up in this belief, but if you don't have this belief, you don't have life. Someone says, "Look, that's ludicrous, because there are plenty of people who don't believe in Jesus, and they're well and truly alive." Of course they are. And John isn't that thick. When he speaks of life, he's meaning more than existence. Throughout his book, he makes it clear that Jesus is trying to tell us there's another life, there's another world even. He often uses the phrase eternal life. It's not just speaking of a quantity of life. You know, existence like the one we got now that goes on and 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 on. That can be nearer to hell than heaven for many. Now, he's speaking about a quality as well as a quantity of life. The phrase includes the ideas of heaven, of a spiritual world, of the kingdom of God. Yes, especially of a vertical relationship with God himself. This is eternal life, he says. That they know you, the one true God, and Jesus Christ whom you sent. Oh, we can turn our backs on that life. But John and the other writers say that to do that is like longing to stay a caterpillar when you were made to be a butterfly forever. And he says very clearly here, Jesus reveals that life and is the means to it, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, and believing you may have life in his name. That's why believing that Jesus is the Christ is a life and death matter. God, John says, God has walked the earth to show it to us. More than that, God has gone to the cross to get it for us. And he has the scars to prove it. What am I doing? Not coming to him for that life. One day I've got to face the God with the scars. Bruce was an Aussie. Had to be, didn't he? He was captured by the Japanese in the last war. He landed up in one of their prisoner of war camps, and one night as he was asleep, he woke up. He couldn't get back to sleep again, and as he was struggling to do so, he noticed across the other side of the hut another prisoner stretch out his hand from his bunk bed and grab the food bowl of his neighbour that was sitting on the windowsill. He took it back to his own bunk, and just as Bruce was about to shout out a warning, he realized what the guy was doing. He took some of his own meager food rations and put it in his neighbor's bowl and then returned it to its place on the windowsill. Night after night, Bruce watched him do that. Give up some of his own pitiful amount of food to help his neighbor. Till finally, that guy died. Mixture of disease, malnutrition, exhaustion, general weakness. His mate survived the war. Now that's a true story. Imagine the scene, though, when Bruce is at some Remembrance Day occasion, you know, around one of those cenotaph things, and he's standing there, his mind full as he thinks back to the war of what he'd watched night after night in that hut. And halfway through the service or whatever, some young unthinking lout comes rushing through on a demo, maybe one of those sort of aerosol sprays, and puts the paint on the cenotaph and dashes off. And as he runs away, he goes past Bruce, who reaches out a hand and grabs him and says, "What do you think you're doing?" And the young lout says, "Hey, come on, don't get so steamed up. How did I know you'd be so serious about it?" What is Bruce going to say to him? Etched vividly on his memory at the time, that sacrifice he'd watched lived out night after night. And the guy says, "Why are you so serious about this?" We won't be able to talk like that young lout when we face the God with the scars, will we? It'd be no good me fronting up to a God I've not bothered with all my life and trotting out some line like that. "Oh, so you are there. Oh, well, how was I meant to know you'd be so serious about it?" What's God going to say to that? Why did I think he'd suffered the scars if it wasn't something vitally serious? I can't look up to that kind of a God and just trot out something like, "Well, you know, I mean, I tried my best. I reckon I lived a pretty good life." He's going to say to me, "Hugh, my Christ showed you what a good life meant. There was nothing to punish in him. He picked up those scars dying for others, being judged in the place of people like you. If trying your best or leading a pretty good life would have been enough, we'd never have bothered to go through all of that. It would have been monstrous to do so. God would have every right, wouldn't he, to shake his head in sorrow at the thought of all he'd suffered to get me life, and I just spurned it." It was Valentine's Day last week. Hope you remembered. Hope you were remembered. Sorry if it's a sore point. I read somewhere about someone who only Valentine card he got went like this: "I'll see your face in the mirror in the morning." But still, that was tough. I was telling some of you the other day that I read in the paper that in Britain we spent £70 million last week saying "I love you" on Valentine cards, postage stamps, £50 million on boxes of chocolates alone. I went down to the Bendix shop by bank to buy some chocolates for my Valentine. She's my wife. Sorry, you're allowed to say "I love you" even if you're married. Well, occasionally. And as I was in there nosing around, seeing what chocolates they got, three times some of those blazered boys from the Futures Exchange walked in, well, swaggered in, because that's the way they walk, and they got their wallets open, bulging with the notes, and they went up to the lady behind the counter and they said, "Excuse me, have you got any of those heart-shaped boxes left?" And the lady had obviously had a good day for sales, because she looked at them and she said, "I'm sorry, there's only the £23.95 box left." And three times the complacent smiles left those faces. And rather limply they headed back for the door saying, "I think I'll leave it." She wasn't worth it. I hope it wasn't you. I'm very, very sorry if it was you. But the point is this, isn't it? When it comes to me, when it comes to you, God did not draw the line at £23.95. He didn't even balk at £70 million. God so loved the world, he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. That's why he's the God with the scars. What are you going to say to him? You say, "Look, hang on, don't push me. I don't want to be rushed. I need to check the evidence." Great. If that's really where you're at, that's all I'm asking. Look, let me tell you about those cards in the middle. Grab hold of one of them and open them up, because they'll actually tell you all you need to know on the inside. They're about some little groups called Discovering Christianity, and it says Discovering Christianity is for all kinds of people, which ought to include you. And you'll find that what it is it's offering 4 evenings when you can just get together and thrash out and see what evidence there is and see whether it does or doesn't stand up to any questions you or others might have got. And all you need to do, if that's what you're ready and willing to do, is simply to tick one of those boxes on that side for whichever night suits you best. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. If none of them are any good, don't tick any of the boxes. But just fill in your name and we'll know that you want some help and we'll see what we can do to lay something on for you. So you tick a box if you can make any. Don't worry if you can't make all 4, but just tick whichever is the best night for you. Give us a name and somewhere we can get in touch with you so we can give you any further details, and then just tear the card in half, preferably down the dotted line. And on the way out, when you go at the end, by the door, you'll find a couple of yellow bins and you just slot it in at the bit with your name on. Hang on to the rest, it'll tell you what you've just said you'd go to. If you've got questions, your friends who came with you tonight, they'll explain more about it. They'll probably be very happy to show you where to come on the night. In fact, if you're not careful, they'll probably fill the card in for you anyway. And on a table by the door there, I'll have those things I've got, that copy of John's Gospel and that little booklet about the evidence for the resurrection. Sure, if what you need to do is not to be rushed but to check there's evidence, do that. We're not interested in people leaping in the dark. We want people to step into the light. But there'll also be people here tonight for whom that's not their position. If you can manage to be honest enough with yourself, and I do not mean this glibly or smugly, it's not an easy thing to be at times. You'll know that what you really need isn't more evidence that Jesus is the Lord and the God. You've got enough of that. What you need to do is to act. To turn to Jesus and take him as your Lord and your God. To come to the God of the scars. There's no point in delaying. You don't need any more evidence. A girl was saying the other night, As she got to this point and her friend was asking what she'd do, she said, "I'm like Ted." Yeah, well, don't be a Ted. These last moments are for you if you need to act. So you'll be glad to know that I've virtually finished. And in a moment, I'm just going to suggest that we're quiet for a second, and I'm going to pray a simple prayer for people who are at the stage where they need to act. And it may be a helpful thing for you to do, simply to echo the prayer as I pray it in your hearts. I'll tell you what I'm going to pray, I'm not putting any words into anyone's mouth. You just listen and see how far you can go with this. Here's what I'm going to pray. Oh God, I cannot hide from you that I've been out of touch with you. I've been resisting your love. And I've gone my own way in your world. I'm going to pray, thank you for giving Jesus to die on the cross for me so that I can be forgiven and have eternal life. I'm going to pray, I turn and take Jesus as my Lord and my God. Well, there you are. I'm through. I'm going to suggest that we're all good enough just to be quiet for a moment or two. We all think where we stand with this God of the scars. Then I'm going to pray that prayer, and if it's where you're at, you echo it. And then I've got one more thing I want to say. So let's be quiet for a moment. Let's think what we're going to make of John's book. These things are written, he said, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Here's that prayer. O God, I cannot hide from you that I've been out of touch with you. I've been resisting your love, and I've gone my own way in your world. Thank you for giving Jesus to die on the cross for me, so that I can be forgiven and have eternal life. I turn and take Jesus as my Lord and my God. Amen.